We stood ankle deep in the letters, which came through the slit in a continuous shower until the baskets overflowed on the floor. And there were Valentine parcels and Valentine hampers. Half of the Valentines were really dainty, tasteless things. Many were decoratively printed on satin with fine lace borderings and little golden thread tassels. But at least 1/4 were coarse and offensive, too much so for descriptions. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. Those are the words of a post office clerk who is remembering the late Victorian period, which is in some ways the heyday, I would say, of Valentine's Day. Tom, are you a great enthusiast for Valentine's Day?
Not normally. And the simple reason for that is that Sadie, my beloved wife, is very, very hostile to displays of commercialized sentimentality. And so she gets very cross if I give her a Valentine's Day card or do anything like that. Although, excitingly, I am taking her out tonight.
Oh, that's nice.
So that's good. However, being lovely on Valentine's Day is all well and good. But you were saying in that 1/4 of the cards were coarse and offensive.
I have some splendidly offensive Valentine's cards to come in the second half of this episode. So don't go away if you want to hear really offensive Valentine's Day
and
messages.
I can absolutely vouch for that because you've been texting them to me, some of them. Yeah. And they really are coarse and offensive. So that is something definitely
that gives you a sense of the kind of banter that we do off when we're not recording.
Sending each other Victorian ditties. Dominic, Valentine's Day, why are we celebrating it? That's the big question,
I don't know, because basically all the questions we had on Twitter and on the Discord for Rest is History Club members, they sort of came from the same, well, they came at it the same angle that people approach Christmas and Easter and things, didn't they? They're sort of, is it a pagan festival that has been cruelly taken over by the Catholic Church, or is it a Hallmark holiday that has been invented by marketing men in Tuscaloosa?
The whole thing is unbelievably complicated.
Yeah.
And I reckon it's more complicated than Christmas or Easter. Because at
more
least
with, complicated.
Well, the thing is, with Christmas and Easter, it's pretty clear why they're happening. The birth of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, these are key events in the life of the central figure in Christianity. But with Valentine, it's a lot more complicated because who is St. Valentine? How many Valentines were there? When was he martyred? Was he martyred? Did he exist? What happened to him?
I hope you're going to answer those questions because I don't know the answers.
So the problem is I don't think that there are any absolute, historically guaranteed answers to this.
Because, so there are multiple St. Valentines. There's not one canonical Valentine.
Okay, so in the Roman martyrology, which is the current kind of compendium of people who were martyred, you get at Rome on the Via Flaminia by the Milvian Bridge, St. Valentine, martyr. So the Via Flaminia is the road that leads from Rome to the Adriatic, kind of over the Apennines. Milvian Bridge will be familiar to all fans of Constantine. That's where he won his great victory. So St. Valentine, the problem is there was also another Valentine who was the Bishop of Terni, which is a place 60 miles north of Rome. And basically, he has the same name. He was a martyr. The Roman martyrology is now saying that these are the same people.
But they're not.
Well, we don't know. We don't know. I mean, maybe they are, maybe they're not. But I mean, if they've got the same date, the same name, the assumption usually is that they're the same person. But then adding to the complication, there's another Valentine who was the Bishop of Genoa, whose feast day is the 2nd of May. And that is important because that comes in later for the question of how and why Valentine comes to be associated with romance. So it's an absolute kind of snarl, a knot.
Yeah.
So probably there is a Valentine. There was a Valentine. He was martyred. His relics were preserved. But the stories that then start to accumulate, how historically accurate these are, very, very hard to say, but almost certainly they're not accurate, I would guess. So when is he martyred? 14th of February. So that's why we have his feast day on the 14th of February. And later traditions say that it was in the reign of Claudius, the Emperor Claudius.
All right, so very, pretty early, really?
Well, no, because it doesn't fit in historically with the early Emperor Claudius, the stutterer, the hero of Robert Graysonburg.
There's a later Emperor Claudius, right?
There is.
3rd century? I don't know, 4th century?
Claudius Gothicus.
So when's he? roughly?
So he is 268 to 70, he reigns. Okay. So he is a product of the third century implosion of the Roman Empire. And he's one of those kind of breed of rugged, tough Novak Djokovic type emperors from the Balkans.
He's been deported from Australia and yeah, vaccination that kind of thing. Difficulties.
He's rough, he's tough. There's a story that he punched a horse in the mouth, knocked out all its teeth.
So he'd be sacked as a primary school teacher if he did that, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he absolutely would. Yeah, he'd get in trouble if he was a footballer. No, it wasn't. It was a cat, wasn't it? He was...
Yeah, the Premier League footballer is a cat. Yeah, so that makes, I didn't think we'd get here in a discussion of Valentine's Day, but I'm glad we have.
Yeah, so he's very... So this Claudius is the second one, is very keen on punching out teeth. Right. So there's a story that he punched a horse in the mouth and all the horse's teeth went flying.
Okay.
And then he was in a wrestling match and his opponent reached out and grabbed him by the bollocks. And so... predictably, Claudius smashed him in the face and knocked out all his teeth. So that's very much his party trick. Right. When the empire is in the process of implosion, it's obviously the kind of talents that you need.
Yeah.
So he ends up becoming emperor, and he's a very good emperor. He's a strong military leader. He defeats the Alemanni. He defeats the Goths. So that's why he gets the name Gothicus. And then he dies of plague. So one of the horrendous plagues that sweeps over the Roman Empire in the third century. And so possibly it's this Claudius, but the problem is that, as you will gather from the synopsis I've given, he's not actually around in Rome very much to go around martyring people.
But he's off punching
horses in the teeth on the frontier.
He doesn't sound like a friend of romance, right? I mean,
no.
He's not the kind of man who'd be immortalized in a middle American greetings card. So,
well, no, but the thing is that he's martyring Valentine.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. That's the point.
So the stories are kind of these are increasingly medieval legends that Valentine is a Christian at a time when it's illegal to be a Christian. He is he gets arrested by a judge. He then converts the judge. Further stories say that the daughter of the judge fell in love with him and that he teaches her to love Jesus and all this kind of stuff. And then Claudius comes in. Also very fond of Valentine, tries to persuade Valentine to give up his Christianity, doesn't, ends up having him martyred. And the story is that he gets beaten to death with clubs. So you've got all these kind of various folkloric, mythic elements of the story that get elaborated over the Middle Ages. And then once you start to get the association with romance that we'll come to, then you start to get kind of daughters of judges and daughters of emperors all get fed into the story.
But in its initial form, there's nothing erotic or romantic in this story at all. I mean, unless you find punching horses in the face.
There is absolutely nothing. Nothing romantic at all.
But is there not an existing festival around this time in the Roman calendar, Tom? Is this the time of the Lupercalia? Have I got that right?
You have. So we've got a question on that from Jim Wackett. Is Valentine's Day a genuine example of a pagan Roman festival, the Lupercalia, that was Christianized and associated with a saint's day?
Yeah.
So this is the equivalent to the idea that Christmas is, the Saturnalia with a different name.
Exactly.
Well, so I will describe what went on with the Lupercalia, and you can see what you think. Okay. So the Lupercalia was celebrated kind of in the middle of February. So 13th, 14th, 15th, that kind of period. So you have got the 14th of February kind of bang in the middle of that. It took place around the Palatine, running into the Forum. So the Palatine is the hill in Rome that ends up becoming the imperial, the palace, obviously. But it's a very ancient festival. It's not the kind of festival that would generate, I think, a huge number of Hallmark cards. So what you have to do, you mark the festival by offering up various goats and a dog in sacrifice, and you take their blood.
See, no one minds the sacrifice of goats, do they? But as soon as you mention the dog, a lot of listeners will be rolling their eyes and saying, dead dogs again.
I think people quite like goats as well.
Do they?
Yeah, I think so.
I think we're less sentimental about goats.
I agree. But
anyway, go on. Sorry, I've sidetracked you. Let's talk about the Lupercalia.
Yeah, so you these dead goats,
yeah.
This dead dog, you mix the blood, you wipe it on the brows of two small boys, and then you immediately wipe it clean again. Mm-hmm. And this is the key thing. The boys then have to burst out into wild laughter. And if that doesn't work, then they have to do the whole thing over again. So,
wow. So there's a lot of pressure on those boys.
Yeah. Well, if you're a goat or a dog, obviously, you know, and you're lined up in case the boys don't laugh.
Oh, God.
There's a lot at stake. Anyway, so that happens. And then what happens is women will basically kind of strip themselves, will go topless, and they'll all gather around the kind of the spurs of the hill of the Palatine.
Yeah.
And the men who are taking part in the Lupercalia will strip right down to kind of very, very skimpy thongs. And they will then start running round the spurs of the Palatine.
Yeah.
And as they go by, they'll be carrying a kind of goat thong, and they will whip the bare-breasted women with the goat thong. And this is in obedience to an oracle that had been given to the Romans, where it said the sacred goat must enter the mothers of Italy. So obviously there are various ways in which a sacred goat could enter the mothers of Italy. This is in a way the least intrusive.
The most decorous.
This is the most decorous way of doing it. And it's a way of stopping stillbirths.
Does it work? I'm guessing
Well, yes,
no.
It does. No, it does. It does. And so this is why women offer themselves up to the lash. They get, you know, get smacked over the breasts with the goat thong. And then they all pregnancies work. So there you go. So that's the Lupercalia.
There's a brilliant description of this actually in your book, Rubicon, isn't it? Didn't Mark Antony do it?
Yeah, Mark Antony does it, yes. That's the one where he ends up offering Caesar the crown.
Yeah.
So that's why it's, yes. That's
he's sort of running
the famous
madly through
example
the streets, isn't he? Yeah.
Mark Antony's very much the kind of guy who would enjoy running around Rome in a skimpy loincloth, whipping women over their breasts with a goat thong.
The bad behaviour of the Bullingdon clubs of history is a definite theme of this podcast, and that is absolutely on trend, isn't it, the Lupercalia?
Well, So this idea that there's an obvious line of descent from the Lupercalia to St. Valentine's Day doesn't seem, it's not obvious.
No, it's not. And actually, if a Roman were transplanted into the 21st century and you said, this is what Lupercalia has become, get yourself
candlelit
down,
dinners.
Get yourself down to Clinton Guards.
Very disappointing.
Immensely disappointed.
Yeah, very dull. The Lupercalia is a very popular ceremony. It has very, very deep roots in the Roman past. And it's not until right at the end of the 5th century that it gets banned.
It's actually banned. It doesn't die out.
It's banned by a Pope called Gelasius, who objects to it. So I think it's kind of 496 or something like that. It gets banned by him. So the question then is, well, how and why does Valentine come to be associated with romance? So you said that a lot of festivals, we assume that they're American.
Yeah.
The current thinking is that actually Valentine's Day is probably English.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. That's good.
And it seems to have emerged against the backdrop of the great literary revolution at the end of the 14th century.
This is Chaucer, isn't
it? Chaucer and John Gower and all kinds of people like that. And the first kind of mention that we get in English poetry is in a poem by Chaucer called The Parliament of Fowls.
Yeah.
Fan of The Parliament of Fowls?
I've seen bits of it on the internet.
Seen the film.
Yeah, seen the film. Seen the cartoon. It's great. Now tell me about The Parliament of Fowls, Tom. I know nothing about it at all.
Okay, so The Parliament of Fowls is an interesting poem.
Yeah.
Because it's the first poem that actually mentions the word election in the sense that we use it now of kind of choosing, choosing someone to represent you politically.
Did election have a previous meaning?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Well, the election of, are you part of the elect? That kind of thing.
Oh, I see. Okay. So this means an election as in a kind of democratic.
An election as in the general election that we'd have now. So the plot of it is that Chaucer is reading a book by Cicero, The Dream of Scipio, and he falls asleep. Scipio appears to him, leads him up through the celestial spheres, and he finds himself in the Temple of Venus, and he walks through the Temple of Venus, and It's very dark, and there are images of unhappy lovers. And then he comes out into this this kind of bright meadow, a hill of flowers, and all the birds are there. And it's their parliament. And this parliament shows the lords, you know, so the top birds,
yeah,
but also the commons. So it's the first representation in poetry of what would become the parliamentary system. And the backdrop to this is the, you know, that's kind of the wave of weird parliaments that you get at the end of the 14th century.
Yeah.
The kind of the good parliament and the bad yeah. parliament and all those kind of various parliaments.
There must be other parliaments than good and bad.
Anyway, so among all this, all the what's happening in this parliament is that the birds are choosing their mates. At mates as in,
yeah,
you know, romantic others rather than
yes,
kind of mates. And you get this verse. For this was on St. Valentine's Day, when every fowl cometh there to choose his mate of every kind that men think may, and that's a huge a noise gan they make, that earth and air and tree and every lake so full was, that underneath was there space for me to stand, so full was all the place.
I liked that Sam Gamgee rendition that you gave initially.
Thank you.
Chaucer.
Thank
voice.
You. Thank you very much. Well, yeah, I mean, so I think you do want to imagine these birds in a kind of a shire, an idyllic landscape, green yeah. hills, all that kind of stuff. And the implication of this is that it's the time of year when, you know, spring is coming, the end of winter, thoughts turn to romance. And so that, I think, is why it's Valentine is associated with, you know, it's the time of year, it's the beginning of spring, it's the sap rising, all that kind of stuff. But again, the question is, why is Chaucer fixing on Valentine's Day? And it's not just Chaucer who's doing this. So John Gower, who is a moral Gower, Chaucer calls him, who's another poet, writes in English, but also writes in Latin, writes in French. And in one of these French poems, Gower describes St. Valentine greater than any emperor, holding a parliament and assembly of all the birds who come on his day, where the female takes her mate in proper love. So again, oh. it's kind of weird thing. What you know? What is going on here?
And these guys, one of them is not copying the other. They're both doing it coincidentally, do you think? Or
well, Gower and Chaucer are friends. So there is debate about this.
Yeah, interesting.
About who comes first. And it's and the precise dating of Chaucer's poem is important because one of the theories about what's going on here and why it's being written is that it marks the treaty of marriage that is being signed between Richard II and Anne of Bohemia,
yeah.
which takes place in 1381. But here is the twist. Is it on the 14th of February, Dominic?
Ooh.
Or is it on the 2nd of May, which you'll remember
was another Valentine
was
day.
The feast day of the, yeah. The Valentine, who is the Bishop of Genoa. So,
gosh, the stakes are high in this, Tom. It's
well, there's
exciting.
No answer. There's no answer. I mean, we don't know. Is the answer?
But isn't this also the backdrop to all this that it's the age of courtly love and sort of chivalric yes. romances and
yeah.
so the whole business about choosing a mate and the sort of. You imagine the sort of almost like the ritualistic dances or something at the courts. This is part of that, isn't it?
It absolutely is. So all that language of courtly love, I mean, Chaucer is very keen on that, translating the Romance of the Rose, all that kind of stuff. You know, the Arthurian myths and all that kind of, you know, Lancelot and Guinevere, all that kind of thing. And it just seems to be part of the language of the English court at this period.
Yeah.
And over the course of the 15th century, so Richard II gets toppled, you get Henry IV who replaces him, and then friend of the show, Henry V.
Yeah.
And in the reign of Henry V, it really starts to pick up. So the very first Valentine that we have surviving, so a poem written to someone asking them to be their Valentine, is by Charles, the Duke of Orleans, who was captured at Agincourt, who gets brought back to England and locked up in the Tower. And
yeah.
he's there in the Tower for kind of years and years and years. And he writes to his wife, I am sick of love, my very gentle Valentine. Je suis déjà d'amour tanné, ma très douce Valentine.
So he calls her his Valentine. So that yeah, expression, very, be my Valentine, very, yeah. people are using it in the 15th century.
His very, my very sweet Valentine. Yeah.
But when he's calling her his Valentine, does he mean, you know, you are the spirit of Saint Valentine? Or has the word Valentine taken on this kind of romantic meaning at that point? I mean, obviously, presumably the latter.
I think the latter, yeah. And so the process by which, you know, what it is that joins Chaucer and Gower's poems in the English court to Charles, Duke of Orléans, coming up with this. I mean, he's in England. He's at the English court. So presumably that's where he's picked it up. And you get, you then get John Lydgate, who's a poet from the reign of Henry V and after. And he's writing in honor of Queen Catherine.
Catherine of Valois,
who's married Henry V and been left widowed and will go on to marry Owen Tudor. And he again refers to Valentine's Day, to look and search Cupid's calendar and choose their choice by great affection. So there you've got the idea of a Valentine is someone that you choose. So like a knight choosing his lady.
Yeah.
So on Valentine's Day, you choose your Valentine. And by the end, towards the end of the 15th century, you've got the Paston Letters. Paston Letters have, I think, three references to people becoming Valentines. So Marjorie Bruce, writing to her future husband, calls him my right well-beloved Valentine. And the idea is also then starts to pick up through into the 16th century that you send tokens to your Valentine.
But these are people you're already betrothed or married to, right? These are not just random people that you've got your eye on, kind of thing.
Well, there seems that I don't think there's a hard and fast rule, because this is an evolving tradition.
Yeah.
So the fact that the feast day of Valentine gets abolished by Edward VI, with, you know, the Reformation kicks in, so Saints' Day's infra dig, but Valentine's Day is kept as the expression of an evolving tradition where there are kind of various possibilities. So by the 17th century, there are various ways in which you can choose a Valentine. So there's the one that we would understand, that you know, there's a beautiful woman, or indeed beautiful man, and you send the equivalent of a card, a Valentine card.
Yeah.
So someone who does that is the future James II, the Duke of York, who sees Lady Frances Stuart, who is reputedly the most beautiful of all the women at Charles II's court, becomes the model for Britannia. And he gives her a jewel worth £800 as a Valentine.
That's a heck of a lot of money in modern times. I mean,
it is. So that's better than a card. Then there's this idea that you can that you get your Valentine by lot, and so there are kind of various jokes made throughout the 17th century that this is how public officials should be chosen.
Oh, right. So people say choose a public official like a Valentine's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the third one. So this is a report from a Dutch visitor who comes to England in 1663. It is customary, alike for married as for unmarried people, that the first person one meets in the morning, that is, if one is a man, the first woman or girl, becomes one's Valentine. He asks her name, which he takes down and carries on a long strip of paper in his hatband, in the same way the woman or girl wears his name on her bodice. And then you get presents from them. So it's a kind of nice idea that this is all done completely at random.
I like that idea, but of course it's quite high risk.
Yes, and the Dutch visitor goes on to say that actually this gets kind of planned in advance.
Yeah.
So, you know, the girl will be lurking around the corner waiting for the boy to run past or whatever.
Right. Oh, that's good. I like that.
So you have the sense of this tradition emerging. Nobody quite knows how, but it's associated with the feast day of Valentine.
Yeah.
And then Valentine becomes associated with all this idea that you choose a Valentine and that it's romantic.
Well, that at this point, you see, it is quite romantic, and it's not commercialized, is it? There's no, because how could it be? Because there's no infrastructure of sort of commercialism that could really exploit it. I mean, that's true, isn't it? It's not commercialized at this point.
Well, as unless you're the jeweler supplying the Duke of York, I suppose.
Yes. And I think that's probably the case into the 18th century, Tom, because I know the Georgians were very keen on Valentine's Day, weren't they?
Well, the only thing I've got about the Georgians is that by the 18th century, you're starting to get Catholics, and indeed, you know, Christians of all denominations, but particularly Catholics, who are starting to raise their eyebrows at what's going on. And it's, as far as I can tell, it's not a kind of, you know, a mocking philosopher or an atheist who points out, who tries to kind of draw this, you know, the idea that St. Valentine's Day is a mutation of the Lupercalia. It's actually Catholics who are doing it. who are opposed to the idea of Valentine's Day.
That's very weird. Why would they be opposed to it? Because they, maybe because they don't want to give ammunition to Protestants who think it's just flummery and stuff.
So, well, you've got Butler. So Butler, as in Butler's Lives, the, you know, the great kind of compendium of saints' lives that gets written in the 18th century. And he says that to abolish the heathens' lewd superstition custom of boys drawing the names of girls in honour of their goddess Februta Juno on the 15th of this month, several zealous pastors substituted the names of saints in billets given on this day.
But that's not going to catch on, is it? I mean, that's...
No, but it's not true. But it's not true. But it's he's trying to explain how it is that... Valentine has become associated with romance. Yeah. And to do that, he has to posit that there is a festival, a pagan festival that didn't exist, that is a match to the idea of people, you know, kind of choosing one another's Valentines. So the whole thing is kind of structured, but it's basically expressive of the fact that we don't know really what the origins of this.
But in a way, it doesn't really matter, does it? Because by the mid-18th century, it's become embedded in kind of folk tradition. You know, the 14th, by this point, everybody knows that the 14th of February is Valentine's Day. There's a brilliant website called All Things Georgian, which has a whole list of things that happened on Valentine's Day in the Georgian period from newspapers. So this is from Reed's Weekly Journal, the 16th of February, 1751. It says, Thursday, one Mrs. Mann, aged upwards of 60, who keeps a cook and chandler's shop in Shoreditch, was married to a soldier quartered in that neighbourhood, aged about 22. That's quite a big age gap. Mm-hmm. Being asked by a neighbour how could she think of marriage at these years, she replied it was Valentine's Day and she was resolved to be coupled. The old now you might think, what's it in it for the soldier? I mean, there's not many 22-year-old young men who want to marry 60-year-old women. And the answer is in the next line. The old gentlewoman had, by her frugality and industry, collected upwards of £200, which she freely bestowed on her new love.
That is so romantic.
What a romantic story.
That is so romantic.
I bet that's a union that ended well. But here's this one. How about this one, Tom, from 1784 from the Morning Herald. It may be worth remarking that on last Valentine's Day, a couple were married in St. Peter's Church, Derby, who had between them seven thumbs, viz.
Well, goodness.
The woman three and the man four.
Wow.
Now that's
more than Anne Boleyn.
Yeah, I mean...
Goodness,
that's a
me.
Lot. That's a heck of a lot. That's more thumbs than you need.
But that's an astonishing coincidence if they just happen to run into each other. Well, but they'd obviously have loads to talk about.
No, but they must have met at some thumb support group.
It must be.
Yeah.
Goodness. It doesn't say how they met.
No, it doesn't. The Morning Herald is very, it's poor reporting,
coy,
isn't it?
It's coy boring, on that. Yeah. It's the obvious question.
Yeah, it's lazy journalism.
Okay, so it's the hints of the commercial are there, I guess.
Well, the fact that they're reporting it and then...
Yeah,
and you've got print, I think, and people are buying it, newspapers. Once people are buying things, then you have...
Dominic.
Yeah.
At the start, you read out that brilliant thing of the postman being engulfed by letters.
Yes.
And I've been looking forward to hearing more about the coarse and offensive... Valentine's got sent. So we should have a break and come back to that. But just before we get, by the 19th century in the church, the idea of Valentine's Day as a day for romance and love is starting to be integrated. So do you know where the skull of Valentine is in Rome? One of the churches in Rome.
Well, one of the Valentines.
Yeah, exactly. But do you know where the rest of them are? The rest of the relics?
No, they're in Wiltshire, no doubt.
No, they're in Dublin.
Are they?
Yeah, they're in the Church of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, Whitefriars Street.
Why are they there?
I'll tell you. There was a very famous Irish Carmelite preacher called John Spratt.
Right.
And he went to Rome and he gave a sermon, a homily, and it was very, very much appreciated. And the Pope seems to have heard it. And so he sent the relics of Valentine to the Carmelite Church in Dublin as a token of his appreciation.
Oh, that's kind.
And so there's a little note, came with a little note. It was taken out of the cemetery of St. Hippolytus in the Tiburtine Way, and it arrived in Dublin on the 10th of December, 1836. And if you go there now, it's very moving. There's a kind of statue of Valentine looking at kind of rosy-cheeked.
Yeah,
so rosy-cheeked and pink-lipped.
So he's sort of turned into Cupid, as I imagine. Has he?
But... He has a slight hint of Cupid, the statue. Yes, but there's a book there, and people can write if they're unhappy in love or if they're looking for love. and Lonely Hearts some very, yeah, kind of spiritual Lonely Hearts book. And it's very touching. So not at all. I saw it on my last trip to Dublin when we had a compendium of unexpected things in Dublin.
Right.
And the relics of St. Valentine were quite high on that list. So we went to see them.
That sounds very romantic, Tom.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
not at all coarse and inoffensive, which is what I hope
will
be the notes we're striking after the break.
Can't wait. See you in a minute.
Okay, bye-bye.
Hello, welcome back to our Valentine's Day edition of The Rest is History, and excitement is rising because Dominic is about to tell us about the great Victorian tradition of coarse and offensive Valentines.
Well, you just have to wait a little bit longer for the coarse and offensive messages because I want to build up to them. Because we talked about how Valentine's Day had become sort of embedded in the Georgian imagination in the 18th century. And it's in Georgian Britain, I think in the second half of the century, that you start to get pre-printed cards. So the ancestors of Valentine's cards. So if you think Valentine's cards were invented by American manufacturers, you are quite wrong. The Americans got the idea from us, from the British. And so first of all, people, Tom, have you ever handmade a Valentine's card?
No.
No, neither have I. Well, we're very poor compared with our Georgian predecessors because they would hand make them. People started to make what they called mechanical Valentines, which were kind of, you know, mass-produced printed ones. I think the first example of a surviving one is in York Castle Museum, and it was sent by Catherine Mostey to a Mr. Brown of London. And it's decorated with pictures of Cupid. So we talked about Cupid.
But what's mechanical about it?
Well, it's made by a machine. It's printed.
I see. I was kind of imagining a moving one.
No.
You know, you kind of like open the box. And a kind of heart leaps out at you.
Yeah.
No. On a spring.
No. It's just a nice message. Since on this ever happy day, all nature's full of love and play, yet harmless still, if my design, 'tis but to be your Valentine.
That's beautiful.
It's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to be reading a lot of poems in this second half, so be warned. And there's actually, in the same year, 1797, somebody publishes a book called The Young Man's Valentine Writer. So a manual about how to write nice Valentine poems. So this sort of becomes more and more popular. And people basically, they're not sealing them in envelopes, they're not cards, they're sort of pieces of paper that you fold over. And they'll have lace on and threads, and they'll be very sort of pretty. But the big turning point, Tom, you know I have a weird interest, well, not an interest in, but a knowledge of the history of the post office.
I do, Dominic.
I commend to the public my own audiobook on the history of the post office called The People's Post. Very good. Very good Radio 4 series, which you can buy at all good audiobook retailers.
Can you?
So you can. Yeah, you can.
That's it. Wow.
Yeah. I've probably got the best reviews of anything I've ever done, basically because I was merely the front man.
Wow. And I must listen to it.
And actual experts did all the work.
I thought I'd kept abreast of all your oeuvre, but
no, sadly not. So there are tens of thousands of Valentine's cards being sent in Britain, supposedly in the 1830s. But the real turning point is in 1840, when you have for the first time the penny post. So before then, Tom, if you sent a letter, the recipient had to pay for it. So the penny post is this great revolution by this postal reformer called Rowland Hill. And the innovation is you pay a penny. So it's democratizing communications and encouraging literacy and so on. You pay a penny and you can send a letter anywhere and the recipient doesn't have to pay for it at all. So it's the penny post in 1840 that gives you basically stamps. It gives us letterboxes in doors. There weren't letterboxes before because you would knock on the door to get the recipient to pay you. And it also creates pillar boxes. So designed, of course, by Anthony Trollope, the novelist.
Yeah. And so, ancestor of Al Murray.
So what happens with all this is that letter writing becomes anonymous. You can post your letter, you know, you don't have to hand your letter in and all that. So the possibility for the anonymous Valentine's card with the recipient doesn't have to pay for. So they get it, as it were, for free, starts to become, so this sort of spreads in the mid 19th century. So Blackwood's magazine says, "The post office system offers a facility for clandestine correspondence, which no respectable father or mother on the European side of the Atlantic would think of without a shudder."
So this is very kind of moral panic, like anonymous accounts on the internet.
Yeah. You know what G.K. Chesterton said about post boxes? He said, "The post box is the treasure house of a thousand secrets, the fortress of a thousand souls." So this sort of idea that the post office has become this sort of conduit for clandestine romance. And it's true because there's this huge boom in love letters and obviously Valentine's cards in the years after the 1840s. So do you know, Tom, how you would write to somebody if you fell in love with them at first sight? Do you know what a letter writing manual would tell you what to say?
Well, to write a poem, I guess.
No. Dear Miss Hawley, you will, I trust, forgive this abrupt and plainly spoken letter. Although I've been in your company but once, I cannot forbear writing to you in defiance of the rules of etiquette. Affection is sometimes of slow growth, but sometimes it springs up in a moment. I left you last night with my heart no longer my own. I cannot, of course, hope that I've created any interest in you, but will you do me the great favour to allow me to cultivate your acquaintance? So that's from Thomas Hill's book of...
Okay, I think that's wrong. I mean, I don't want to diss Thomas Hill, but I would write a poem.
Do you know what Miss Hawley writes back? He gives an example in Miss Hawley's reply. Sir, your note was a surprise to me, considering that we'd never met until last evening. And that our conversation...
sounds so feminine.
And that our conversation had only been on commonplace subjects. Your conduct is indeed quite strange. You will please be so kind as to oblige me by not repeating the request, allowing this note to close that correspondence.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So
exactly.
You are Whereas vindicated. You're totally
vindicated. Yeah.
So anyway, people start, you know, because they basically can't trust themselves to write poems and, you know, they can't be bothered to copy out these passages from kind of love letter manuals. They buy printed Valentine's cards. And the king of the printed Valentine's card is a man called Jonathan King, who's a stationer in London, late Victorian stationer. And there's a collection in the Museum of London. You should go, Tom, on one of your walks. They have 1,700 different cards, examples of cards that Jonathan King made. They're often very, very fancy. Here's a good example of a card, of a message in a card, Tom. The card is made out of human hair, which is hallmark.
What kind of hair?
Human hair. Well, all it says here is human hair fashioned into...
Well, you know how Caroline Lamb expressed her devotion to Lord Byron.
I do indeed, but I bet she didn't fashion it into a moustache, which is what this card.
Okay, nothing says love like a lady's pubic hair fashioned into a moustache.
Well, I think you're imagining that first bit of that, Tom. But the card that the moustache comes with a message that says for the new woman. With St. Valentine's heartiest greetings and best hopes, she will receive another moustache with the man attached.
Oh, I see. It's the man sending the moustache to the woman.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So Britain actually at this point absolutely led the world in Valentine's cards.
So proud.
And American publishers, American stationers would issue catalogues with lists of their imported British Valentine's cards. So I've dug one out from 1847 and the categories are absolutely splendid. Comic, sentimental, lovesick, acrostic, funny, burlesque, witty, arabesque. It goes on and on, listing all the categories. And then at the end, it says, enlivening, heart-aching, despairing, raving mad, heart-killing, high-flown, lampooning, romantic, proposal, espousal, matrimonial, hen-pecking, suicidal, and many other varieties.
Suicidal?
Suicidal. But there's a woman in Worcester, Massachusetts, who our American listeners may have heard of, called Esther Howland. And she basically decided that she could do better. Well, she said they're too expensive, all these imported British cars, and there's a huge market for it in America. So she set up her own business.
Did she undercut British?
She did, but I think they were very good. She basically copied verses from English Valentines.
It's a timeless story, isn't
it? And imported sort of materials from Germany and stuff, and it became a tremendous empire. And I think for half a century, until it was actually overtaken by the Hallmark Company, which started up in Kansas City in 1910, hers was the biggest sort of American.
So it's a complete metaphor for the decline of British industry in the face of American and German competition.
Yes, I suppose it is. I mean, they were absolutely amazing, these Valentine's cards, by the way, Tom. They were far, far better than, so they were much fancier.
The American ones.
Well, the Americans and the British ones of the 19th century, the real peak of people, so many of the questions we had on Discord and online were, you know, is it a 20th century phenomenon? Is it sort of a Halloween? I think that's the assumption, isn't it, in Britain, that it's basically a romantic Halloween, a commercial Americanized tradition. But actually, Valentine's Day, I would say, was much bigger between about 1840 and 1880 than it is now. And it was British manufacturers being copied by Americans. Now, you wanted coarse and offensive.
Yes, I do.
The one bit of this that we've completely lost touch with is the vinegar Valentine. And there's been some splendid studies of this, that particularly as a scholar called Annabella Pollan at the University of Brighton, who I should acknowledge, who's written lots of articles and stuff about this. So vinegar Valentines were cards to insult people, and they were exceedingly popular. So, for example, they would have a sort of caption on them. So here's one that the caption says, Miss Nosy. And you would send it to a woman you disliked. And it would says, on account of your talk of others' affairs, at most dances you sit warming the chairs. Because of the care with which you attend to all others' business, you haven't a friend.
And Dominic, this would be commercially made, or would...
Yeah, they're commercially made. There are loads of them. You'd go into WH Smith's or whatever, I mean, the equivalent, and you'd buy a vinegar Valentine, you'd send it to rival podcasters, for example. So, for example, Tom, I might send you this. You're as vulgar a cad as I'd wish to meet, and yet you're devoured with pride and conceit. But I fancy before very long you'll find out that everyone thinks you're an ignorant lout.
Goodness.
Imagine receiving that.
Yeah, so, I'd feel
actually, that one is not appropriate for you. This one is much better. It just says on the front, are you Gertie Gabber? Are you Gertie Gabber, Tom?
Not as far as I'm aware, but...
Well, wait for it. So this is what the poem says. Gertie Gabber does not know her talking can quite tiresome grow. Her tongue keeps wagging all the day, and really nothing does she say. Then there's another one called Show Off. And obviously not appropriate for you at all.
No.
Show Off. You claim you're good at anything. So come on, show some proof, and let me see how good you are at jumping off the roof. So these were, they started.
That's amazing. So you can buy these.
Yeah, in the American Civil War, soldiers would buy this one. It would say on the front, and they would give it to their doctors in their, the sort of surgeons in their platoon or whatever. And it would say on the front to the surgeon, ho, ho, old sawbones, here you come. Yes, when the rebels whack us, you're always ready with your traps to mangle, saw, and hack us. And you would send these on Valentine's Day to people you disliked. But my absolute favorite one of these, which I really wish somebody would bring back, the front of the card says, you are a nerve destroyer. when a pig's getting slaughtered, the noise that it makes is sweeter by far than your trills and your shakes. And the howling of cats in the backyard at night, compared with your singing's a dream of delight. Your squalls and your bawls are such torture to hear, a man almost wishes he had not an ear. If someone would choke you and thus end their pain, hearty thanks from your poor distressed neighbours he'd gain.
Wow.
You wouldn't get away. That's top trolling, I think, is the...
It really is. And the idea that that this is making lots of people money.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes today's internet look an absolute model of good behaviour.
Yes, it does. I was astounded when I came across these, because, of course, we sentimentalise our forebears. And we think, oh, they're so innocent and all this sort of stuff. And actually, this is, you know, the height of sentimentality of Victorian Britain and America. Sort of Little Women, Emily Dickinson, you know, Robert Browning and so on. But actually, you know, people are sending these.
But it's the anonymity,
horrendous,
isn't it? That's the key. I mean,
anonymous,
as you said,
Valentine's Day. Yeah, yeah. No one knows. Yes, exactly. They're unsigned. And you just think, God, I'm Gertie Gabber.
Well, no, yeah, or people think I'm Gertie Gabber.
Yeah, I've been singing.
I'd say that's not true. I'm not, but that's what people think.
Well, that's the thing. You think you've been singing by the piano to entertain your relatives night after night in that sort of Victorian way, but actually they wish someone would choke you. Yeah. It's wow. Harsh, isn't it?
And when did this custom kind of fade?
It seems to have died out around the end of the 19th century. I don't really know what.
Back.
I think there's a sort of diminution in Valentine's Day generally, around about the turn of the 20th century.
And I think any entrepreneurial card manufacturers listening to this,
yeah, of course,
I think there's a gap in the market.
Don't send them to us, though. I mean,
no.
Other history podcasts are available. Send them to them, but not to us. So we've got some other stuff, haven't we? That, I mean, obviously Valentine's Day, things have happened on Valentine's Day.
Well, there's been a massacre, hasn't there? So I think they've got a question on that. Skinny Dan.
Yeah.
The St. Valentine's Day massacre in Chicago needs a mention.
It's got nothing to do with St. Valentine, though, has it? Or romance?
Nothing says romance like gunning down.
Like Al Capone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gunning down people in garages.
So Valentine's Day Massacre, for those people who don't know, is a, it's the shooting of seven men on Thursday, the 14th of February, 1929, in Lincoln Park, Chicago, in the north side of Chicago. It comes towards the end of the Prohibition period, when Chicago has basically become a sort of a bit of a sink, riven by gang violence between two gangs. One of them is the North Side Gang, who are mainly Irish and Polish, and the other are what's called the Chicago Outfit, who are run by Al Capone. So they're Italians, and they're fighting mainly over the kind of brewing and liquor distribution. The two gangs had tried to make peace, but failed. Moran had sent people to go and try and kill Capone. Capone's actually spending a lot of time in Florida by now. He's that sort of gangster as celebrity, the first real gangster as celebrity, I suppose. But basically, that this Thursday morning, some of his men disguise themselves as police officers. They go into a kind of garage on the north side where some of Moran's men are. There are also two kind of bystanders. There are five of Moran's men, and two bystanders are kind of an optician and a mechanic, who are sort of caught up in the sweep, and they basically, you know, line them up against a wall and machine gun them.
And they all die.
They all die. And the weird thing
is, so even the poor optician.
Well, the optician was sort of vaguely associated with the Moran gang, as was the mechanic. They were sort of hangers on rather than full on kind of, but they were killed.
Seems odd for an optician.
Well,
you can kind of get
too.
A mechanic. Yeah, but, you know, mechanics you can see, but an optician.
Yeah, but maybe if
you
need
want
to
hang out with gangsters.
But if you're going to be a gunman, you need good eyesight.
That's true.
I mean,
yeah, specsavers.
So the only one of them is sort of really alive at the end of it. So he's dying. He's called Frank Guzenberg. He was a real hoodlum for the Northside Gang, but because of the sort of omerta cult, you know, the sort of you can't speak. And when the police arrived, the police said to him, "He's got 14 bullet wounds." And the police say to him, "You know, who shot you? Who shot you?" And he says, "No one shot me." So obviously he has been shot, and he denies having been shot right up to the point where he dies. It seems absolutely self-defeating.
Impressive.
But the Valentine's Day Massacre was very important, Tom, because it was a very big scandal. It encouraged the federal government to move on Capone. Obviously, they charged him with tax evasion, famously, in 1932. But it helps to bring down the city's mayor, William W. Thompson, who was corrupt and was in league with the Capone people. Do you know what the Chicago Tribune said when he fell from grace?
No.
For Chicago, Thompson has meant filth, corruption, obscenity, idiocy, and bankruptcy. He's given our city an international reputation for moronic buffoonery, barbaric crime, triumphant hoodlumism, unchecked graft, and a dejected citizenship. He made Chicago a byword for the collapse of American civilization. Nothing says romance to me more than
that's
moronic buffoonery.
Is it right that the involvement of the police is suspected in the Valentine's?
Well, they've never actually. Well, there were people disguised as police, and they had police uniforms.
Oh, okay. That's what it is.
But what the Capone, all these gangs were very, very tightly interwoven with the Chicago police and with the Chicago authorities. So actually, yes, in a way, Tom, there was such intense corruption that the dividing line between the gangsters and the police was virtually imperceptible. So yes, you're right in a way.
Okay, so nothing says romance like gunning down people in a garage. Other things happened. Captain Cook was killed.
He was indeed, yes. Yeah,
friend of the show. Gregory the VII, my favourite pope. He excommunicated Henry the IV on this day.
Oh, God, you love that story.
I do. Well, we're going to do an episode on that at some point. So this is the 11th century.
Yeah.
Henry the IV is the emperor. Gregory the VII is the pope. They're meant to get on. They don't. Henry the IV says to Gregory the VII, "Step down, come down, give up your papacy," to which Gregory responds by excommunicating him. And as he does so, the papal throne splits in two.
Wow. Do you think he contrived that?
Dominic, I don't think it really happened.
Oh, okay.
I don't think it really happened.
That's so often the case on this podcast.
I know. But the most recent thing, of course, that happened within our lifetimes was the issuing of the fatwa against Salman Rushdie by the Ayatollah Khomeini.
That's kind of vinegar Valentine of a very vinegary.
That point. Really is a vinegar Valentine, isn't it? Shame you didn't do it in rhymes.
I shouldn't laugh, but yeah, if he'd written it in a sort of Victorian style.
How I hate the satanic verses.
I'm there are bad books, lots of curses.
And there are worses. Yes. Apologies to Salman Rushdie if he's listening to this. So that was obviously a big deal. Anyway, so I think that's pretty much St. Valentine's Day, isn't it?
I think we've been sort of building up to that, haven't we? When I first started doing this podcast, I really wanted to get to a point where we would be issuing fast
speaking pass. speaking in verse. I mean, I like to think of this as a Valentine's Day card to our listeners.
Yes, it is, Tom, actually. And since you've said that, I think we should end with another Valentine's message. This is a genuine Victorian Valentine's message. Maybe not appropriate for all our listeners, but for one or two, perhaps. The kiss of a bottle is your heart's delight and fuddled you reel home to bed every night. What care you for damsels, no matter how fair? Apart from your liquor, you've no love to spare. Goodbye.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Bye.